Welcome back to Camera Creations, our podcast, which is now on show number 16. We had a bit of a cock-up on the last scheduled meeting a fortnight ago. Sorry about that. But we decided to shelve it, and so it's been a month since the last one. But have we got a show for you today? Because it's a very interesting topic of infrared photography. It's Thursday, the 26th of February, and I'm joined today by Ian, Chris, and Charlie, with the possibility that Joe might be joining us in a little while. So we'll watch out for that. Hello, gents. Everyone all right?
Hello, Ted. Yeah, all good.
Good,
yep, yep, all good.
All had a good month. Are taking lots of pictures, have we? We'll probably come to that actually as we go, won't we? Just a couple of reminders to say that the website is still at tedsalmon.com /camera creations. There's the Camera Creations shared album, which you can click on the link to in the show notes and follow along as we're talking, because we will reference photographs that are in there from the guys here. MeWe Group is where we try to encourage some conversation about cameras and photography, so do join us there. Links in the show notes, also links at tedsalmon.com, which I'll reiterate again later. But today's theme, as I say, let's get straight to it. It is infrared photography, and just to give you a bit of background from my perspective, this is something back in the film days that I dabbled with. I had some filters, and I remember the base principles of only letting infrared light through and blocking everything else, and having to use a tripod because everything was a long exposure. And I dabbled with it, and then after I dabbled with it, I kind of gave up and never did it again. So hopefully the digital age and your enthusiasm can bring more to this conversation than that. Who's going to kick us off? Charlie?
Charlie, you're on mute.
All right, he's gone already.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I shot infrared for the first time about 3 weeks ago. I bought a camera in the UK, and I was actually traveling around Asia, and I managed to get a full spectrum camera conversion for infrared in Hong Kong for £100. They're about £350, £400, I think, in the UK. So I took a few pictures, mostly in Thailand, because I was unable to get hold of an infrared filter. I was shooting with a 665 nanometer filter.
And should we give some background onto the nanometer situation and what a full spectrum? Because
I think this might be a bit confusing. It. Yeah,
okay.
I think you'll be able to explain it better than I can with the nanometers.
Yeah, so infrared photography is kind of measured in nanometers. So you apply a filter to your camera, which lets in light rays over a certain nanometer count. So I think the human eye can see between 300 and 720, something like that. I might be wrong, but I think it's something in that range. And then you can get infrared filters, which normally go from 590 nanometers, 665 nanometers, 720 and 850. So like the 591, you get a small bit of visible light, and then you just get infrared. And then the 665, it's less visible light and just infrared. And then 720, it's all infrared. And 850 is a very harsh infrared. So you might have seen these infrared images where it's kind of like they're crazy colors. They're pink and orange. And that is normally in the 665 or the 590 infrared. So when you get a infrared conversion, it removes the infrared cut filter, which cuts out the infrared light. And what Charlie did was get a full spectrum conversion, which removes all the filters, and then you have to add on your own filters.
Yeah.
So I should clarify,
when you say add on your own filters, we're not talking about a filter over the lens. We're talking about...
No, over the sensor.
Sensor in the camera, yeah.
How do you put that in then?
With great difficulty. When I
just to say that Joe's now joined us. Hello, Joe.
Hello.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Joe.
You've arrived just as we're having a fascinating discussion about applying.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm intrigued by it.
Okay, sorry, Charlie. Well, back to you.
Crack on, Charlie.
How do you put it in the camera?
Yeah, so you get this clip-in filter, Ted, and it's a bit fiddly because there's a rubber gasket you have to put round it, and I forgot to do that. So I put it in, and I was like, oh, my God, there's something wrong with my camera because the autofocus kept on bouncing back and forward, like off different objects when I was trying to focus on them. And then I realized it was that the filter wasn't in correctly. It was kind of loose. Yeah. I didn't put the gasket on it, so I put that on. And fitted it in correctly. It is quite fiddly to do, and then the autofocus worked as it should. And I managed to get some fairly good pictures, I think, after a bit of experimentation. As Chris was saying, with infrared photography, it's all about how light responds to different surfaces with the invisible light, and that's what the filter does. It kind of... it blocks out, well, it doesn't block out, it reveals the light that, that the human eye can't see, and it bounces off different surfaces stronger, and that's where you get those increases in luminance, brightness in the scene. So instead of shooting and looking at colours, you're looking at how bright or dark different compositions are, and that is kind of like relearning photography. It's not necessarily easy.
So which filter did you use for the images that we're seeing in the group? This is in Ayutthaya, Thailand, I think, from the pictures.
Yeah, I use the 665 filter.
665. Yeah, so you're getting visible light, which gives you a bit more colour.
Yeah, so most of the pictures, when I take them, obviously when you load them up into Lightroom, they come out red. Yeah. But once I've done the channel swap, they're blue with the foliage being slightly kind of golden, like a sepia golden color. Mm. But you have to really mess around, you know, do a heavy color grade to get the look you want. It looks kind of like it's a filter, but it's not. It's actually the infrared spectrum, and it's quite difficult to do, as I'm sure you're well aware, you know, editing. Infrared. It's not straightforward.
It's quite a process.
Wouldn't this be easy to do post shooting in the edit? Do it later, or is there some reason that that's not so good?
You can approximate it and get quite close, but if you're shifting the colours to that extreme in an edit, you often get quite a lot of artifacting, especially around foliage,
right?
Because of the high levels of contrast, and it's kind of the foliage scenes which are the most appropriate for infrared.
Okay.
Because chlorophyll reflects infrared light, so which is why this isn't the best time of year to be doing it, because we haven't got a lot of leaves on the trees at the moment and things like that. But the more vibrant the green, that will come up as bright orange in sort of like a 650 nanometer infrared photo, and it will come up as a very, very bright white in 720 to 850.
Right. And can you see this through the viewfinder? Because one of the things I seem to remember from back in the film days is that when you looked through the viewfinder, it was just black. You had no chance with focusing, either manually or with autofocus. You just couldn't see it.
Yes, you can with a converted camera. The problem you had is the same problem I had, is when I first tried to do an infrared photo, I just got the filter, which you just screw onto the lens, like a normal filter, which cuts out visible light and only lets in infrared light. But the trouble with that is the cameras have what's called an infrared cut filter into them, which is why you'd want them to convert them. So what that does is it's with the lens filter, it's only letting in infrared light, that it's hitting the sensor's filter, which is blocking infrared light.
Right.
So there's kind of a struggle there, and for that reason you have to have incredibly long exposures, and use a tripod. So when I looked at this for my originally, just did a quick bit of research, I was told that there was like a 4 to 7 stop loss of light with the filter. But what I didn't realise is a Sony camera that I have has an incredibly strong and effective infrared cut filter. So I was doing maybe 5-minute exposures just to take a normal photo in the middle of the day.
Right.
So, I mean, you can, if you look at the first photo in the camera creations group, that is one that I took with my Sony camera with a screw-in lens filter. And you can see in the metadata, that's F8, and that's a 60-second exposure.
Can you describe which one it is for the listeners?
Apologies. That is, it's like a windmill, black and white windmill.
Right.
In my browser, it's coming up as a second image at the top of the page. Okay. As you can see in the metadata, that was with my Sony a7R5, 60 seconds in bright sunshine. And I even had to raise the ISO to 320. So you can see that normally that would have been like a 1/500th of a second kind of image.
Yeah.
So that shows you how much light is getting blocked out with this filter, which is why I ended up buying a dedicated converted camera, which the following images, the bright pink ones, were taken using, which was an old Canon camera that I got. Sorry, I've just walked all over your one, Charles, so I don't know if you want to go back to your experience. Charlie?
He's gone again.
Oh, he's gone again. Stop. He's back on mute.
You've upset him.
Oh, dear.
Charlie, are you... You seem to keep muting yourself. Oh, sorry. He's back. Oh, that's it.
Yeah. I'm back now. I don't know why.
Sorry, Charlie. I went off on a tangent and we got lost from what you were doing with your...
Yes, I was going to say your windmill photo, Chris. What nanometer were you shooting at?
That's a 720.
720.
Yeah.
It's a good photo, but for someone that isn't into photography, let's just say you went up to a man in the street, he would say that it looks like an inverted black and white photo.
It is. I mean, it...
Yeah, it doesn't, because, it doesn't scream infrared, that's what I'm saying.
It's because like the, no, because the white, the bright white image that you would normally get where things look like it's snowing, that's the typical image, that isn't there because I just wasn't getting enough light in.
And would you say that the in the plants you said about the
chlorophyll,
that's what makes it bright white, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so obviously when there's no leaves on the trees, you're also going to lose a lot of luminance.
So your other picture of the windmill, which is sixth in on the page here, is that more of an example of what you're talking about there? Because all the foliage is very snowy looking.
Yeah, so that was taken with, so I struggled with the screw-in lens filter, so I bought a converted Canon camera, which is an old Canon EOS 100D, which is an old DSLR, and those images are in the group, they're the pink and blue images, and I really like those images, and I thought, well, I'm really enjoying this infrared. But I don't really want to have two camera systems and two lenses for the infrared. So what I did is I went back to the chap that I bought the Canon from, and he had a Sony A7, which would use the same lenses as I already have for my normal camera. And he sent that across, and that is what was used for the remaining images where you got the snowy white. Is with the Sony A7, I think, even the so in the metadata you can see it's a Sony 7, it says there. That was with a 720 nanometer filter, so you can see that the whiteness is a bit more vibrant, it's a bit more luminance to it, because you're just catching the infrared light a bit more cleanly than I was with the screw-in filter, and it's the same location, so you can see the difference. But what you can also see in that sixth image down is around the windmill, it's like a grey spot. I don't know if you can see that on there, where the blue of the sky is kind of not there. That is what's called a hotspot, and infrared photography suffers with a lot of zoom lenses. They like prime lenses, so all the images, so you'll see it again on the 9th image down. That's a different windmill, but you can see like around the middle of the frame there's like a discoloration. So I looked into this, and sure enough, the only solution was to buy more lenses. So so this is after I've already bought a screw-in filter that didn't work. That was £80. I bought a Canon DSLR and the lens. That was £300. And I enjoyed that, so I sent them back, and I bought the Sony camera, which was £250. And I thought, right, I can see where this is going. More lenses, more filters. So I, in the end, I returned the Sony camera, and now I have no infrared camera and no options for infrared. So there's a beginning and end to my infrared story, and it has ended.
Sold your prime lens, your 35.
It's due to the looming money pit that I could see coming my way, and I thought, no, this is ridiculous.
Because you all know it's going to happen if you own a camera.
Just a quick question, chaps. I know the answer probably, because I mean you're very skilled at editing, and I know you won't get exactly the same results. But how close do you think you could get with just editing?
Very close, I'll be honest.
Yeah.
It would take a lot of work, though, would it?
No.
I think once you figured out a workflow, you could do it. Yeah. I was hoping to try it myself, but I didn't have time. I've just been so busy the last week or so. But I did want to give it a go and see how close I could get with a normal photo.
But I think the thing is, Joe, when you're taking loads of photos, I still haven't figured out a way, because I use Lightroom Mobile and not Lightroom Classic. But once you have a collection of images all shot in infrared, you can just like, you know, make a preset and just add it instantly without having to
with
the individual colors, because each picture will have like a different tone and luminance. And you know, you couldn't just like take a color and apply it to all, but if it's all been shot in infrared already,
then yeah, you can see it straight away.
Yeah, it'd be a lot easier to do. I can't do that at the moment for technical reasons, but I think it would be easier with an infrared camera once you have the software set up.
It's similar to like if you had a black mist filter, you can kind of replicate the look in Photoshop, but you'd have to sort of edit every single photo to see what worked. But obviously if you're doing it in camera, then you'll see it straight away, whether it's a photo worth persevering with.
Again, you can probably make a quick action for that, like a black mist, as you can with the infrared, but because each photo is different, I think it would be quite tricky. They won't come out the same.
I appreciate it takes away the joy of taking the image, though.
Some reward to it, you know, when you're out there and you're getting the images and then you're seeing them when you get back. And you...
Chris, the third image you've got, which is where the trees and everything is in pink and the sky is very blue... That was from the Canon you bought.
The Canon, yeah.
Yeah, and was that sort of straight from camera, or how much work did you put in to do that?
That is what's known as a channel-swapped infrared. So out of camera, the sky is more pink and the leaves are more blue. And you actually see that in camera as well.
Because I see some of Charlie's images, very similar sort of colour scheme with the...
Yeah.
The same sort of blues and pinks as we go down.
Yeah, so
I just wondered how much work was involved to get that.
Not too much. So you just open it in Photoshop and you literally just swap the red and the blue channels, the values.
He makes it sound so easy.
Yeah, my challenge was opening Photoshop, to be fair. So.
It's not too bad. I mean, that pavilion photo of the pink trees is probably the favourite one I got out of all the infrared photos I took. And that kind of hooked me, and then I just ended up on this kind of spiral of anxiety with the rest of the infrared stuff. But no, it's not too bad. Yeah, it's just a quick Photoshop action. Once you've done it once, you can save it, and then you can do it pretty quickly. And you can also export a Photoshop preset into Lightroom, and then it's saved as a Lightroom profile, and you can just apply it as you would any other Lightroom profile. So there are workflows in place, so it's not too bad, Ian.
Okay.
If you get the chance, yeah, definitely give it a go. But as I say, as you mentioned, it's not the best time of year, really.
I would disagree. I would say it is actually quite bad. Editing the photos for me, I found really difficult. The way I got the colours that you see and why they're so different is what made it difficult. I used the colour select tool in Photoshop, where it gives you 6 or 7 different colours and you're allowed to actually manipulate each layer. So it's kind of different to the hue saturation tool. That's what I used to get the effects that you see. Out of camera, they were just red images. And I did what Chris said. I did a channel swap, and I also did a level swap. But I still didn't get the colors I wanted. I had to use a mixture of the color select tool, and then I added the gradient on some of them, and a lot of masking and a hue saturation to get the effects. And that was for each individual photo. For technical reasons, I couldn't make an action and just apply it to all the photos. I tried that, but they weren't coming out how I wanted them. Like, one image was good and the rest were bad. So I found it quite challenging overall.
Okay, so looking at your photographs, Charlie, it looks to me as though they're differently to Chris's, that there is a kind of almost like purpley haze across them, and not so much kind of clean colours and clean hues. Is that probably what you were saying just then?
Yeah, and that's quite normal with the 665 nanometer filter I was using. Usually the hues come out darker, generally. Okay. It was very challenging, I found. And also, each of those images you see, there were a lot of them were shot at the same site, but they look quite different. To get the trees kind of that cherry blossom look that you see, took quite a bit of manipulation in Lightroom and Photoshop, going back and forth between them. So I'm sure I was doing something wrong. Although individually the images look okay, I wanted to create like a collection, so they're all the same. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't able to do that, really.
Right. Except the one that's got the three statues across the middle, up front and centre, that looks very different because it's got, the pink of the leaves is very clear and more like what Chris has done with his.
Yeah, I used what's called a threshold mask on that one. So basically it selects the luminance of an object, and I use that to select the trees in the background. That was the best way. And then from there, I basically increased the saturation of the trees, and it turned pink for some reason. So I kind of like the look of that. But again, if you're a beginner in Photoshop, you wouldn't know how to do that. It was difficult to mask those trees to select the color. So there was definitely a learning curve for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's enjoyable. I found the editing process enjoyable, and I hope to get better at infrared. I'm definitely not going to give up. I'm not going to throw the towel in like Chris did.
I guess you've also got someone looking at this from the outside might say, what's the point? Why are you doing this? Is it because you're bored with normal photography and you want to just do something different?
We're saying it from the inside as well, Ted. What is the point? But we keep doing it anyway.
I think from the outsider looking in, it looks like I've just slapped a filter on it, doesn't it? And of course, we all know that it's not. But that's what it looks like. I showed these photos to my sister, and she goes, oh, they're very nice, but why are you using a pink filter? I'm like, it's not a pink filter. She goes, yes, it is. I'm like, no, it's infrared. But, they don't know, so...
Yeah,
my favourite one is the fluffy hats for £20.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, that one, you can see the hot spot as well, right in the middle of the frame.
Yeah, but I like that about it. I think it's a good thing for some reason. This image, it works.
It is fun. It's just it is a bit of a faff. To be honest, I should have just kept that Canon that I got, because all the best images were taken with that I've got from the infrared.
Was that the Canon then, that one?
No, that was a Sony.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was the Sony. Yeah, the Canon ones are the ones that are a bit more vibrant pink, like the windmill ones. And the
okay.
Chris, one. Why are the zoom lenses, why are they suboptimal for infrared? Why are they worse?
I don't know. I'm sure there's a scientific explanation. It does seem to be common that zooms aren't very good for infrared. I think it might be the way that light bounces around the inside of the lenses. I don't know exactly, but it's hard to get information about what lenses work and which ones don't. And I didn't really want to sort of be throwing money at, you know.
Isn't there like a list? Like
there is a list, but the list was wrong because the list said that the 24-70 that I had was good. Yeah. But it wasn't. I've got clear hotspots. But apparently the simpler the lens, the better it is. So if you got the sort of cheapo Chinese stuff, that should, in theory, be good.
So I asked Gemini, and she goes, because of the internal lens elements, that causes diffused light scattering and internal reflections. So like you say, that creates the hotspots and focus shift and stuff, yeah.
Yeah,
well done, Gemini. Cheers.
Cool.
I was quite disappointed that the Sony kind of infrared stuff didn't work out for me, and I might go back to it, but it is a bit of a faff. I'll be honest, Chris.
You said it didn't work out for you, but you're wrong. I mean, your photos are really good, and you didn't do much to edit them. So it's obviously a win for you. I don't know why you got rid of the Canon. I think it was a Canon. I like those pictures the most.
Yeah, because when I showed you the Canon, Charlie, you made fun of me and made fun of my camera.
And then I went out and bought a camera.
And you said, why are you doing infrared photography? Who would do something so stupid and pointless?
That's till I saw your images, and then I just went out and bought one. I had to have it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting, though. It's an interesting diversion. And it's been around for a long time, but... Like you say, Chris, back in the day, we just stuck something on the front of the lens and we couldn't focus, and we just had to kind of rely on pot luck, really. Whereas it sounds like it's a bit more technical now, particularly if you remember to put the gasket on.
Yes, you need your gaskets for sure.
Okay. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, I hope we didn't bore people to tears. talking about nanometers and...
I was just going to say that Charlie has made... You have made some notes in the recording notes. Is there anything there that we haven't covered in those points you've made?
Not really. I think Chris did a better job than I ever could about explaining infrared.
Okay.
I don't really have much to add, no.
Okay, that's fine. That's good, because there's also lots of other interesting photographs in here, and I suggest that we leap to Ian now and ask him to lead us through what he's been up to and for the last month, and some of these very interesting looking photographs to highlight.
Yeah, sure. I'll just look at my notes. So it's sort of early season for me. So I did a couple of shoots, one at Snetterton Rally Stage, which I've done for the last couple of years, which is first weekend in February. It's always wet, cold, but it was very well attended, pretty good. Still learning my way through. I am doing a little bit of work with Honor as well, around doing some comparisons between using full frame cameras and what you could achieve with a phone camera. And again, no spoilers there. I think you guys know what the answer, especially for fast moving stuff, panning shots and things like that. You can get the odd decent photo maybe with a phone, but you're not going to get anything of any quality with movement in it or anything like that, I don't think. So,
but we won't tell on that. We will
show the good ones. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm still trying to edit through. But no, so I did the rally stage. It was a bit of a practice. There was an interesting one I think I posted on the group, which had some of the marshals and the car going through the background at speed, so that was blurred. So I was quite happy with that. But again, takes me a little while to get back into it and take some shots, but interesting ones of people and things like that. Last weekend, I went to, there was an event called Race Retro, which is in Stoneleigh Park, just outside Coventry. It's a sort of car show, exhibition. They also have a rally stage, which again was some good fun to shoot. Just some various images. I did take my sort of black hole filter. I've got a few with that. There is a shot of a Ford Escort, a blue one, with the filter on it. I think there's something I can get from that. That isn't the shot I wanted, but that was using my Nikon Z6, which I'm still trying to learn my way around. It's not as sharp as the Z8, and I feel I may end up binning it and just going back to another Z8. The shot next to that, which was of an Audi going around the corner, again, it's not as sharp as I'd like it to be. But again, it was an opportunity to have a practice and play. The highlight or low light was there was a Ford Anglia, which was going round, and it caught fire, which was a really scary thing. I put one image in the group, but I've also put in a sort of series of images. Again, quite scary stuff, shooting it and then stop shooting it. There was a moment where the guy couldn't actually get out, and it was a sort of freezing thing, but he did manage to get out in the end. But there were some quite dramatic shots of the car on fire. And again, it didn't hit anything. It was just something that broke on the car. But again, it was a moment to remember.
The interesting thing about shooting fire from, you know, back in the day when I was trying stuff like this is that every nanosecond of the frame is going to be completely different to the next one. That fire moves so quickly. And if you look at those 1, 2, 3, 4 shots there, you can see that the formation of the orangey flames is just completely bizarrely different from every frame to the next one, which makes it quite an interesting series of pictures, I think, which is taken in a very short spell of time, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was a moment where I was with a couple of friends and you stopped shooting because, again, it looked really, really serious. But then you wish you hadn't stopped shooting when the guy got out. But as I say, a friend of mine did get him running away from the car and things like that, which was quite dramatic. But it did bring it home how dangerous this stuff is. It doesn't need you to make a mistake. Something can go wrong on the car and it can go up like that, which is quite scary. And as I say, there is an image of what it looked like afterwards. And ultimately, I spoke to the guy, and it was his pride and joy and everything. So it was quite a series of photos, which was interesting, but also quite shocking at the same time.
Yeah. Very interesting. I think my favourite one of those, in terms of an interesting image, was probably the fourth one with flames. I think the array of the flames is the most interesting. The door's slightly open, and it just seems to work best for me, that one, even though it's not straight as such. It's on an angle, but that, maybe that helps it.
I say there's quite a few because I shot it, and I also shot it at quite fast shutter speed as well, so it did sort of freeze the action a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was interesting. But it is there for sort of practicing and trying to get myself back into it, and after sort of not shooting too much over the winter. The only other thing to mention is that I'm part of a camera club, which I never seem to go to, but I've tried to do a turn over a new leaf this year. So they have regular competitions. So I submitted an image into that, which was the first image there, which was the sort of pseudo black and white one, with a theme of weather. So there was probably 60 images, either framed or PDIs, and there's a professional judge going through, giving critique, which was, I think for mine, it probably wasn't relevant because it's quite sort of sterile, but it was interesting to see someone giving critique over images, and seeing things that are sort of blowing into the frame and things like that. So I did learn a lot from someone giving critique to other people's images, as well as mine. As I say, mine is more of a commercially shot, whereas there's lots of snow scenes and things like that. So, but yeah, a learning curve, and it was good to see someone, how they critique an image and how they see things that maybe other people don't see.
Yeah, yeah, I do agree. I think camera clubs are good for that. When I belonged to camera clubs in the past, I was always fascinated by submitting a photograph and then the comments that came back. And you look again at it and you say, oh, yeah, you're right. That could actually have been a bit better, couldn't it? And you start to challenge yourself. So I think those camera clubs do have a place. Of course, you have got to turn up now and again.
Yeah, I've cheated over the last years of just submitting PDIs and then see what the score I get back on it. But I think the real value is actually sitting down and seeing people actually critique the images. So I think it's worthwhile. But and also it's really good because it seems like I'm pretty much one of the youngest people there. So it's quite cool from that perspective as well. I don't have that very often. So.
Very good. Okay, thanks for that. Some very nice photos indeed. Right, who'd like to go next with their non-infrared last month of photos?
Not me, because I haven't shared any.
Would you like to
do mine, and then Charlie can do his?
Can you do yours, Chris?
Or interesting. I'll quickly get mine out of the way because they're really boring and uninteresting. But
I beg to differ, actually.
The weather being as it is, it's been a real struggle to get out there and do anything, and I haven't been anywhere, so I'm just in Brighton at home. So all I've got to share really is a few foggy images up by Stammer Park near where I live, which they're kind of atmospheric. I like the ones there at the bottom of the Camera Creations photo group. You'll see them. I put on a Fuji Classic negative filter on them. Called it a day, really. Maybe a little bit of color grading. So that was last weekend. And then this country, the next day, you can see some beautiful sunshine, which was a rarity over the last few weeks. And so I just went down to Brighton Beach. If I had never been there before, I probably would have got some nice long exposures or something, but I've done it all at Brighton Beach. So I just sort of wandered around and just took a few sort of snaps here and there. And I put the two that I like in the group there. I like the rows of people and the silhouettes. Shows how busy the beach was and gives it a little bit of sort of context. And with the wider scene next to it, showing all the way out into Worthing. So that was me over the last few weeks.
I like the silhouettes one. Yeah, that's really, really cool.
Yeah, it was probably my favourite one of the day. But, it's a struggle, isn't it, when you just go to the same places and there's so many variations of the images you can get. So
I like I like the portrait one. I think that's my favourite of those. The portrait one, looking into the mist and the two shadowy figures down the road somewhere, and the whole frame is the frame is kind of framed by the trees all the way around, and I really like it's very atmospheric. I like that.
A scene from a horror movie, that one.
Actually, I'd just like to add, Chris, your final image, the one with the silhouette with all the people sitting on the beach.
Yes.
I really like it, but I would have made the silhouette like completely black, basically, as like a stylistic...
High contrast.
Yeah, I think that really would have worked, yeah.
I did sort of try that, and you kind of end up with a very sort of black bottom of the frame.
I don't know if it would look good, though. In my head, it looks good, but I don't know in real life if it would work or not.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to crop that one, you know, the very end, where you've got the sun and... to make the sun central and make a vertical crop. I think that'd be quite nice.
Yeah, that could work. I did try and get something like that in camera, but trouble is in the angle, you kind of don't get the row of people quite the same.
It's almost as if there's little tea lights on the stones.
Yes, I noticed that, and I was like,
that little glow.
I was getting paranoid. I thought there was something wrong with my camera, because I thought, I've got all these spots everywhere. And I was like, oh no, it's just the sun reflecting.
Yeah, it looks so unique.
Are you low down, Chris, or...?
Yeah. I do like the low-angle shots, and I like to make use of my little tilty screen. So, yeah, I'm often seen sort of squatting down, taking these pictures, yeah. I was quite close as well. It's closer than this picture looks, because it's quite wide-angle, it's 24mm. So I was getting some funny looks. Half of the course. But, yeah, that was it, really. It's just been such a struggle, isn't it, in this weather, to get out there and get anything.
Unless you're going somewhere like Hong Kong or something.
Yes, I suppose that's a good segue into
some Chinese. It's basically cheating, guys, isn't it? I mean, you go to Hong Kong, there's no excuse. It's just cheating. You know, I should just take pictures in Brighton, shouldn't I?
go on then, Charlie.
I'll
try and be quick. So I've got 10 photos here. The first one, as you can see, was taken in what's called Hong Kong Central, which is basically Hong Kong Island and the banking district. My knees really hurt on this one because I had to crouch down very low. My tripod, I couldn't fit the skyscrapers you see in the image. So I was shooting on the Samyang 14-24, and I shot this one at 16mm. 2.5 seconds, f11. Took me about 45 minutes to get this shot. It was actually like, I wouldn't call it a traffic island. It was like an inlet. There was like a square of concrete, and I had to balance on it with my tripod. And that's how I got the shot. And there were like four roads, two trams, one for like two trams, and then another one for two buses. And I eventually got that shot. It's two compositions merged together.
The composition's great.
Thank you. Yeah, I had an idea in my head what I wanted to get. It took a few attempts, though, Ted. It wasn't necessarily straightforward. The next image was exceedingly difficult. This is five exposures merged together. So there's three taxis. One image had two taxis. The second image had another taxi by itself, so I wasn't able to get three taxis together. And then the other two images had the light trails for the two taxis and another image for the other taxi. And the final image was for the highlights of the electronic billboard you can see in the left-hand corner in the background. That was blown out. So I had to bring the details back in, something that Chris showed me how to do when I first got into photography. So thank you, Chris. So that's five exposures merged together. That took me over an hour, maybe an hour and a half to get that.
I've got some questions. It's masterfully done.
Thank you.
Really, really good. So the light trails, is it just one image for all of the light trails?
No, the light trails, that is three images for the light trails.
Coming out of the taxis, are they the same or are they all different?
No, they're all different. So the actual taxis, I think one of them has the original light trail, and then I just did it in reverse. Instead of having the taxi forward, I took the original image and blended the taxi in behind its light trail to make it.
Because presumably you do a fast shutter for the three taxis that aren't moving.
Yes, of course, yeah. And then merge it in, otherwise it would have been too...
But then you need another taxi for the light trail, don't you? Because the trails have to have the white bit off the hood and everything.
Correct. Right. So I think it was five images. It might have been six. It wasn't more than that, though. It was a complex image to do. And as I was taking it, there was this, I think there was some kind of art school next to me, and they had like a film camera, and they were like trying to figure out how to use it. and they wanted to know what I was doing. And of course, I was there so long that they didn't see the final result, unfortunately. But it came out well. I was really happy with it. But it was a very late night in Hong Kong. A tip for anyone shooting there, shoot before 10 p.m. because they turn off all the lights after that time.
Oh, no, really? Oh,
wow. I learned the hard way. I missed out on a lot of photos because I turned up at like 11 p.m. and everywhere was like turned off. It was really disappointing. The next image is my first panning shot. I took many panning shots, but I particularly like this one because I have a guy in the back, the guest in the taxi. And you can kind of see his face, him smiling, which I liked. I really had to play about with this because apparently, and Chris will know about this, the shutter speed depends on your focal length. And I was shooting with the 24 to 70. I shot this at 36 mils. ISO 100, F13. F13 might be a bit high, but I just find I like my images quite dark. I don't like them too bright. And I was really happy with that image, really happy with the detail. The next one was something I don't usually take. It's just pure architecture. I wanted to go for compression. Now, unfortunately, on this trip, the lens I had with the most compression was the 24 to 70 again. 70 was my longest lens. So I zoomed all the way in at this one. And I think it came out okay. I put a lot of masks in Lightroom, maybe about 8 or 9 masks. And basically, you know, accentuated what I wanted to stand out. You can see like some bamboo scaffolding in the background. And there's a figure there walking on the sky bridge. I thought that was good because even though I had it without him, I thought it kind of added scale. And scale is very important in composition. You know, it really adds.
I think he would have looked more prominent if he was in that next window to the left because it's a... There'd be more contrast, if you see what I mean, because the building...
Yeah, I see what you mean. I wanted him in that... I had him in both windows, obviously, but I wanted him in that window. I just thought it kind of looked okay. But you're right, yeah, more contrast if he was in the other one.
This one looks infrared.
It does a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Infrared. I should have posted some of my Vietnam photos, actually. I had some Vietnam ones where they looked infrared, but they weren't infrared. I think I posted them in the group chat, though. So you might have seen it. The next one is another Hong Kong one. This was taken on Causeway Bay. Now, this was really difficult to do because, number one, I didn't bring my tripod and I just thought it would look good in a Dutch angle. So when I held my camera up, I had to angle it, obviously. And this took about 30 minutes of me taking it trial and error. Heavily photoshopped. But I think it came out quite well. It was hard to get the perspective right. So I was playing about for a long time in Photoshop to get that. Shot this at F8.
Brilliant. It's my favourite one of yours.
Yeah, mine too. Yeah, I think that's epic. Yeah.
It's fantastic. What did you do in Photoshop, if you don't mind?
I spent most of the time playing about with the composition. Lightroom just, even though you could do composition, like perspective edits in Lightroom, I just couldn't do it. So I spent a long time in Photoshop doing that.
What do you mean? That you distorted the perspective?
Yeah, I distorted it, then I added a skew, what's the other one, Chris? I've actually got Photoshop open doing something else on my computer.
There's warp. Is it warp?
Warp. I didn't use warp. I used something else. I used skew, distortion, and
Skew, distort, perspective, and warp.
Perspective. Yeah. I used skew, distortion, and perspective to get the look I wanted. And then, believe it or not, the road surface I had difficulty with because it was newly tarmacked and it looked like it was AI. So I had to make the road look more believable. So I had to add many overlays over the road to make it look more dirty and grungy because the road looked too clean. And then the time of day was wrong. It was a bit overcast. So I added shadows to the taxi as well. Those shadows are fake. They're not real.
The shadow on the floor was fake.
Shadow on the floor was originally there, but I accentuated it. And then the shadow on the taxi and on the taxi roof where the taxi light is fake.
Well, it looks great. I think that's sets the picture off, that sort of shadow coming across the back of the taxi.
Yeah. It came out quite well. I was really happy with that. And also you've got the leading lines as well, which is really cool. I shot that at f8, 1,000th of a second. With this one, I just wanted the freeze action.
Yeah.
33 millimeters focal length, ISO 200, shot with the 24-70 GM2. Then I've got this one. This was the famous, you will know what it's called, Chris. I can't remember the basketball court.
I don't know what it's called. I've seen this.
Or something, I can't remember.
I've seen this image a few times.
Now, I turned up. I was very lucky. There was only one or two people there, so I quickly got this shot. I had to Photoshop in the far right edge because with perspective correction, there was like, you could see the sky and it wasn't quite right. So I just Photoshopped that in by duplicating the left side of the building to the right side. But otherwise, I was quite happy with that. It came out really well. The next one is
just one thing on that, Charlie, and it's an epic shot. Would you think about removing the half the palm tree on the right hand side, or did you try and do that?
That was not there. So that is actually no. That was there, I believe. That was there originally. I had to mask in the top right-hand corner, maybe 50% of that length of the picture because it was sky. And it just didn't really match the composition. I think that palm tree was already there. Mm. I see what you mean. I could have removed it, but I just decided to keep it, I think.
Okay.
Maybe I could remove it. I think there's a thing where you can go almost too far, then I'd start removing signs and...
Yeah, I think it's it's off the edge of the image and it's sort of cut off.
I would say if you look at the composition, if you look at the photo as a whole, you will see on the left-hand side, you've got a break in the building where it's like a red wine colour on the brickwork coming down. And that's not copied over in the building. So the image isn't perfect. But
It's not symmetrical.
It's not symmetrical.
If you were going to take away the right-hand palm tree half, then you would also think about maybe putting the one behind the basketball hoop in the centre, so taking a step left. But the idea here wasn't to be symmetrical, I don't think.
No.
It's also replicated, isn't it, by that palm tree. Is it an exact copy of what's just to the left of it?
Yeah.
What I would have done is cut it in the whole image in half and mirror it, and then it would have been exactly symmetrical, but I'm...
Yeah, but that's just like outright cheating, isn't it?
Yeah, that's... Well, I've done it many times. My best photo from Tokyo was exactly that.
Really?
The one on the escalators. That only half of it was real.
The next image is me dangling my feet off a 30-story block. Not really. I was actually lying down on the floor with my feet in the air. I felt a bit ridiculous, actually, because I was there for about 10 minutes at Oyman Estate, just like with my legs in the air, trying to get the right kind of perspective with it. I think it came out quite well. I actually went there with a 9mm and it was far too wide with my legs. It looked better without my legs in it with the 9mm, so I had
it's a great idea there. Though it's just really creative, and you know, who would think to do that?
Yeah, so
must have looked quite the sight laying on the floor.
Yeah, I had people who lived in the block kind of looking at me. They just kind of stared at me. And I was like, what's this?
There's another one.
Yeah, Chris, you're always laying on the floor. So,
Was it easy to get access in there, Charlie?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, go on in.
Was it easy to get access into the building?
It was, actually. So I took a few shots of these buildings where they had like this this open part right in the centre. The first one I went to, I didn't think to put my feet in the air. That was exceedingly difficult to get into because there was about four buildings and they were all kind of sealed off. It was almost like a computer game level trying to figure out how to get in. With this one, it was relatively straightforward. The access was kind of hidden or restricted, but I managed to get in. and then it's just like an open walkway, and I just lied down with my camera and started shooting, and I got the image I wanted. Apparently, I was told beforehand that you have to watch out with their clothing because they hang it, and that can ruin the composition as they're hanging it to dry. But I was lucky. I didn't have any washing lines in my way. So I was happy
with
that.
Great shot. Really good shot.
Thank you. The next image I think Ted will like. I basically wanted to go all out and make it look like film. So with this image, I did shoot at 100 ISO just because it was nighttime. But in post-production, I did everything I could to distort the image. I added a black mist effect in Photoshop, multiple layers of masking. The composition was actually as it was shot in camera. I didn't actually crop it. The man at the bottom was a silhouette added from Photoshop. I did actually have a man in there. He was actually painting the ceiling and he was on the ladder and it just looked a bit odd. So I removed him and put the silhouette in. And I was quite happy with how that came out. Hmm. I tried to add light pollution into the sky as well because the sky was too black, which ironically is what I want in most of my shots. I'm like pitch black sky. But with this one, I wanted the opposite. I wanted like a kind of orangey look with light pollution. And yeah, it looks, yeah, unrecognizable from the original, really.
The light bleeding is really interesting. And it almost feels like it's star filters or something. I like that.
Yeah. So I was happy with that image. And the next image was a couple kissing in Chinatown in Bangkok. Unfortunately, I had to merge the two photos together. I was actually more concentrating on the neon sign, which I got as a reflection in the pool. But the couple kissing, when I caught them, I noticed they were actually kissing underneath some Thai flags. And I thought that really looked cool with the silhouette. So I merged the two photos together. They were right next to each other, but I couldn't manage to get them in the same frame. So I had to merge it. But I was really happy with that. Took a while to get the color grade right, because I was going for like a red color grade, but it looked like it was completely photoshopped, you know, with the red neon signs. So I actually went with a yellow tone, and that came out really well. It kind of like matched kind of the natural watercolor. And my final photo is What a Room. This was really tricky. This took me about 50 minutes to take with a tripod, and I had loads of street bros kind of like gather around me asking me for my settings, so it was quite annoying. There was a lot of signage in the foreground that I removed in Photoshop. I decided to keep some of the signage just because I thought it added to it, and this is a double exposure to compensate for the two signs, the Wataroon and then the Japanese restaurant sign, because they were blown out. So I brought the colors back in with the second exposure. And with the first exposure, I just basically just did a light color grade on it, really. It was like it was in camera. But it took many shots because Wataroon wasn't coming out in focus for some reason, but it did in the final shot. So I shot this on the 85mm lens, which I'm very happy I brought with me. I only took one shot with it, and it was this. Shot at f11, 3.2 seconds, ISO 100. This is a great photo, and there's also a starburst right at the bottom of Wataroon, you can see somewhere there. Took about 20 shots of this, and this was the best one. That's a summary, really, of my photos from my trip. I also took a few in Vietnam. I didn't post them because I had COVID in Vietnam, so I only took 10 photos in Vietnam that were actually okay, but I think the Hong Kong photos were better. So, yeah.
That's a shame. How did you deal with having COVID and being abroad?
Oh, it was terrible, Ted. I got COVID in, so I landed in Thailand, and 4 days after I arrived, developed as I was on my way to the airport to Vietnam. I was only in Vietnam for 5 nights, and it started to disappear, I think, on the final night in Vietnam. And then on the day I arrived in Hong Kong, it had almost gone. Right. So I didn't go. I was out in Vietnam for maybe 4 hours shooting in the entire 5 days. The rest of the time I was just in the hotel eating hotel food. Didn't go out. Yeah.
What a shame.
It's what it is, really. Yeah.
Were you on your own? Did you have someone with you?
I was on my own. I was on my own.
Okay.
Yeah, it was quite terrifying, really, because, I mean, I could walk, but barely, and I was going through the airport and the security, and it was just a horrendous experience, really.
Yeah.
Especially when you go to a new country and you're by yourself and you're ill.
Yeah.
But I got through it. It was okay once I was in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
I was okay. Yeah.
Cool. Well done. You must have strong antibodies or something.
Well, I mean, I recovered after 5 days, so that's not too bad. But it was the worst bout of COVID I've had.
Right.
But yeah, Vietnam, very interesting country. I'm definitely going to, I'm going back there in October.
Cool.
I went to Ho Chi Minh. I hope to go to Hanoi and a place called Da Nang, for photography, obviously. And hopefully I can get some proper shots this time around.
Super. Thanks a lot, Charlie. Really good summary. And we're glad you're okay again. Chris, tell us what's in the land of rumours and news that's worthy of highlighting.
Not a great deal, so that's good. I'd say Samyang, everyone's favourite. Samyang will be supposedly launching some interesting focal lengths. I put them in there because the focal lengths are kind of deliberately weird, to the point where I'm thinking, are they useful? So we've got a 60 to 180 2.8, a 28 to 135 2.8, which sounds like that's going to be enormous, a 20 to 50 f2, and presumably they're saying a very fast 28 to 85, so that might be around the F2 mark as well.
Do you think they're just pulling numbers out of a hat?
Well, it just feels like they're just doing different focal lengths for the sake of it, to me.
It certainly does.
I mean, 60 to 180, that's just ridiculous. Stupid to me.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's just me or if anyone else is looking at these and thinking, I'm not sure if there's any...
No one's going to buy that.
...use for any of this, really. Yeah.
Depends how much it is.
Well, it's Samyang, so it shouldn't be too expensive.
No, exactly. If it was £2.50, I'd have one.
Well, let's not get carried away. When I say not too expensive, I'm saying they're going to be about £1,000.
Oh, right, okay.
Most likely, yeah. Something like the 60 to 180, probably be about 1,000, I reckon.
Wow.
But I don't know if anyone else is seeing any utility with these focal lengths, but... Not for me. I don't know, Ian or Joe, anything there that would intrigue you focal length-wise?
No, let's be real. I think everyone just wants like a 12 to 24 and a 24 to 70. That covers pretty much every shooting option, doesn't it?
It's the Holy Trinity for a reason. I don't see any point in these. So.
And the 70 to 200, the Holy Trinity. And that's kind of all you need. I think a 60 to... What was it, 180? Seems very unique. And also, what's the weight trade-off? That's a big factor for me. How heavy is that going to be to carry?
Presumably quite. What do you reckon, Joe? Have you got anything positive to say amongst all this negativity?
Yeah, just shout out to Samyang. If you want to send the chaps the lenses over, you might be able to prove them wrong, you know, and they might give it a go. So.
As if
they're listening.
Mr. Samyang's definitely a listener for sure.
Yeah.
That was all the rumours. I just thought they were interesting focal lengths. On the same theme, confirmed new releases. We got this Tamron, a make that I don't have a very good history with. Tamron 35 to 100 2.8. Another. Half of this, half of that focal length, in my opinion. You either go wide or you go long. What do you guys think of this?
Well, I don't really know much about Tamron as a brand. I mean, if you had to choose between Sigma, Tamron, and Samyang, who would you choose?
So Sigma. It's not even a question. Yeah. What about the focal length rather than the brand?
What is it, 30 to 100?
35 to 100, 2.8.
Again, how heavy is it? I don't really think I would need that focal length, in all honesty. I'd rather just have my Sony GM2 24-70. That covers almost all options, all bases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks quite big as well, I think. I mean, from the image, it says it's the new Street King, but yeah.
I don't see how, yeah.
That must be what Cameron sort of told him. That's the aim.
With that wad of cash that went with it.
Absolutely,
Tamron used to have a really good reputation in terms of a third-party lens manufacturer, and it was certainly up there, if not better than Sigma. But perhaps times have changed that.
They still do, for the most part. I don't like them because I've tried about three Tamron lenses. I had their Halo 35-150 f2 to 2.8 lens, which was quite expensive and incredibly heavy, and I didn't like it for various reasons. But they're definitely behind Sigma now,
right,
in the third-party standings.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, Sigma are basically up there as first-party in terms of quality,
right,
at this point.
Okay.
So,
talking of which...
So, yeah, another new release, yeah, talking of Sigma, this one's got me tingling. 35 1.4, I had the 35 1.4 Mark 1 Sigma. They've just announced the Mark 2, which is... Oh, I didn't put the price on here. I think it's about £900. No, it's £850, I remember now. Which... How much is the GM, Charlie?
It retails at £1,400, but if you buy it off the grey market, I think you can get it for about £11.
Yeah, so...
But is it any better, the Sigma Mark 2?
It's meant to be, it's the same weight as the Sony, which is always the big...
Right. What about autofocus? Is that going to be as good as the Sony?
I don't think you're going to really have any issues for the sort of lenses that the 35.
Yeah, I mean, my 35 is amazing, which you'll find out when I lend it to you in Morocco. It is a fantastic lens.
But if I was buying a new lens, a new 35, you're talking about £600 difference. I mean, I would get the Sigma. Personally,
well, no, because I paid £1,100 for my Sony.
Yeah,
if you're willing to, you know, gamble and go on the grey market, and getting it for £1,100, I think it's okay, and it's only £200.
Yeah, true, but I mean,
I wouldn't pay £1,600 for the Sony lens, not full price.
I will be looking. Because when I go to Thailand, I'll be looking to pick up another 35. So I'm hoping that this new Mark II Sigma will push the price down of the Mark I. I might just pick one of those up.
Get the Mark I. I was just about to say that.
I mean, at the moment, they're about 500 secondhand, but I'm hoping to get it below 400. Yeah. But we shall see. But that's all there is in the news. One more. Nikon. They do overpriced lenses. Maybe Ian would want to.
Yeah, I put this in because obviously just try to get some decent glass into the conversation. But yeah, the 70-200 is epic. The 2.8, I love it, and they just bought out the Mark II version, which I think is shorter, 25% lighter. It's a superb lens. I love it, and I use it with the teleconverter as well. And, but this one, I think, is £2,003, I think.
Yes.
Anyone wants to buy me one, I'd love it. It comes with free shipping, if that helps. But but I'm not sure, as say, unless something happens to mine, I don't think it would be worthwhile changing it. But I might try and borrow one. If I get to see Nikon this year, I'll see if I can borrow it and see what the difference is.
How can they justify that price, though? I mean, it's what is it, £600 more than the Sony?
Yeah, but it's Nikon. This is the thing. It's
exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I've been quite happy with the original version. But how much is the 70-200 Sony?
I think it's 2,100. I think
is it?
Okay. For the Mark II GM, yeah, okay. Around about £2,000, I think.
Is this the F1.8? The F2.5?
Yeah, the 2.8, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's about to, yeah, because one of our friends is on the lookout for the Sony, but it's hard to justify the cost, really.
And the weight.
And the weight, yeah.
I'm looking at getting the F4 for when I next go away to Hong Kong, but I wouldn't get the 2.5 because it's just, the weight's too much.
Yeah, I've got the F4. It's a great lens, so it's there's pretty much no compromise.
You know, you don't notice the aperture, you know.
No, exactly.
I'm with you, Ian. Nikkor's rule.
Nikkor is the way to go.
My love for Nikon and Nikkor is completely historic, of course. I've got no idea what they're like now. But if I had to choose a system, I would just go with it because I used to love it so much. And that lens just looks stonkingly attractive. £3,000 or not. If I had as much money as Chris had, I would get one.
Well, it's the Waitrose of cameras, so you take your choice.
Right, okay, we'll leave it there.
You could buy, I was going to say, Ted, quickly, you could buy Ian's Z6 that he doesn't like, can't you?
Yes, please do.
I'll take 12 months payments on it, okay? I mean, you know, to offer you 12 months payments. Let's wrap it up there. We've got a show in the bag there. We're an hour and a quarter in, or thereabouts. It's been a really good chat. Thanks very much to everyone for turning up and having a nice chat about things. Even Joe in the background there. Joe, tell us you're having a really busy life at the moment, but tell us if you've got plans to go out and take any photos in the near future.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't buy this full frame camera just for my content. I do plan to take stills with it. I just think I'm just waiting for the weather to turn a bit nicer.
Yeah, I guess so. That will make a big difference. You get out and about with it then, no doubt at all. Okay, well, thanks for dropping in as well. TedSalmon.com/camera creations is our website. The Camera Creations shared album is linked from there as well, as it will be in your podcatcher. MeWe Group is where we natter about all this stuff as well. Links to all of that you'll find at TedSalmon.com. So do come across to the MeWe Group and talk to us about that. We should be back in 3 weeks' time, by the looks of it, for our next show, when the guys will have all been travelling and all been coming back with some amazing photographs. We said before the show that we almost don't really need a theme for the next show because there's going to be so much amazing photographs, as long as they don't all get COVID and end up in hotel rooms. And so we'll be back in 3 weeks' time. Until then, thanks for listening. Bye for now.